Court will now call Robert S. Johnson versus Jeff Green, Mayor of the City of Arlington, Texas, Max Maxwell and Faith Burden. Let this court, Mr. Andy Taylor, who argues for the appellant, Mr. Robert P., who argues for the appellant.
Mr. Taylor, you may proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Couple of points that I'd like to make this afternoon about this election contest. First, we properly pled it as an election contest, and therefore the court below had jurisdiction to hear the contest. If you agreed with that, then the order that was signed below dismissing on the basis of no jurisdiction was wrong, and that should be reversed. We also believe that once you decide jurisdiction exists, that you can reach and render judgment because both sides had competing summary judgment motions. All issues were joined as being matter of law questions, and therefore we would ask that you rule that the prior court's, the lower court's ruling denying our motion should be reversed and rendered granting our motion, and likewise, conversely, the motion from the defendants that was granted should be reversed as a matter of law. If you don't agree that we did a proper job of pleading an election contest, then we argued in our briefs and we asked below for the opportunity to amend our pleadings, as the Supreme Court of Texas has often said, because that's a matter of pleading deficiency rather than a matter of law. So with respect to that, I'd like to begin by speaking of why this is an election contest. This is an area I've been practicing 32 years, and when you want to dispute the outcome of an election, then it's an election contest. The person who has standing to do that is a registered voter. The judge who hears the contest is not a locally elected judge. Because of the inherent politics in an election contest, they've and the legislature have said, we're not going to have an elected judge in the territorial district where the election occurred hear the case. We're going to have someone else outside that district hear the case. So they're specially assigned to hear the case, and that is what happened here. When you look at what occurred, there's only one path for us to have challenged this result, and that is by an election contest. The case law is very clear. When citizens band together and submit a citizen petition, the purpose of which is, in this case, to amend the charter for that particular municipality, if they have enough signatures, and there's no question in this case there were enough signatures, if they have enough signatures, as soon as it's submitted to the city secretary, in this case, he has a ministerial obligation to accept it. He can't sit there with discretion and say, yeah, no, I think this is out of bounds. He's got to accept it, ministerial duty. The best case about that is In re Woodfill. That's my case. I tried that case, argued it in the Supreme Court.
But you're not complaining decision. About the city secretary. You're complaining about the petition gatherers, are you not?
Both. But what I'm complaining...
What are you complaining about the city secretary about? He did exactly what you just said he was required to do.
That is correct. I misspoke. Excuse me. What I'm trying to convey, though, is that the city secretary doesn't have a choice. It's ministerial. As soon as he gavels down on the petition, then the city council has no choice. The point of that argument, Your Honor, is to demonstrate that my client, who is a petition signer, who alleges he was deceived when he signed this document into believing that incumbents were protected when in fact they were not. This is the only path for him to be able to challenge it because the city's not challenging it. Indeed, they wouldn't have challenged it because they accepted it and the ministerial duties kick in. So that's why I brought that up.
Tell us about a case, but what's your best case for your position that petition gatherers are election administrators?
There is no case that says petition gatherers are an election administrator. The text of the statute is in 221.003. There's no case on this specific question you're asking. There's no case for or against this position. This is a question of first impression. Does the petition itself and the statements contained therein match what's in 221.003 of the election code. We contend that it is, and here's why. First of all, this isn't a case about whether illegal votes were counted. It's not a case about legal votes being discarded. It's not a case about people who had a right to vote not being allowed to vote. All of those are part of this statute. Doesn't have anything to do with this. But what it does have to do with is 2C like CAT, where it says engaged in other fraud or illegal conduct or made a mistake. Now, what precedes that is in number 2, an election officer or other person officially involved in the administration of the election. I go back to my original point. When the petitioner signed that document under the Bloom case, Supreme Court Bloom case, they are acting as the decision makers. They're the actual administrators. They're the ones who are putting this election into motion.
Bloom doesn't say they're administrators.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Bloom doesn't say they're administering the election.
No. What Bloom says
is they have standing to challenge how their petitions are treated in terms of the proposition that's put on the ballot. Well, but that's as far as Bloom goes.
To be more precise, Bloom is talking about whether or not, either before the election or after, a petition gatherer and signer has the justiciable right to complain about the ballot language. The ballot language. What I am saying
is specifically left to election officials and the city under certain the circumstances to determine how this proposition is going to be put to the people for purposes of their vote.
That's exactly right, and that's my argument. What 52.072 of the election code, it's subparagraph A, specifically says the city is the one who comes up with the ballot language. So we've got the citizen petition and the misrepresentation that's in there that says incumbents are protected, which they're not, juxtaposed with the actual language on the ballot. Now, if you believe that the way we pled our election contest is insufficient to get the job done, we specifically asked for the right to amend, and we were not given that right. What the case law says from the Supreme Court on down is that
you didn't act on that request. You stuck it in a response, and then you didn't ask for it after the fact.
Well, I think the record will belie that statement, and here's why. The judge that made the decision and entered the order was appointed to the Court of Appeals. His length of tenure in office expired the same day he signed the order. So we had a ruling, and then he left that very same day. The case law is clear that in the absence of special exceptions, which there were none here, then the case is, and it's a jurisdictional point, not a substantive point, jurisdictionally, did we say enough to get the job done? What we said here is that the citizen
request that another judge be assigned by the presiding judge to finish up for motions for new trial or anything else.
The judge ruled there was no jurisdiction. So the judge ruled
but the case has no jurisdiction. I understand that. But his ruling, there still is jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction on a motion for new trial. If you still think there's jurisdiction and you still think you're entitled to a right to amend, an opportunity to amend, then that's still, the court still has that jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction, and you didn't do anything with regard to getting another judge in there so that that could happen.
But you're correct that we didn't ask for another judge to get involved. When the court ruled there was no jurisdiction, we then took it up. But the case law doesn't put the burden on us prior to the ruling to request and actually amend. That's not what any of those cases stand for. What the cases stand for is, on a jurisdictional question, you have to accept as true everything that's in our live pleading. And so the non-movement who says there's no jurisdiction may say that they don't agree with what we're saying, but you have to accept as true what we're saying. And then with that acceptance, and in the absence of special exceptions, the question is this just a pleading defect that causes this to be a problem, or is it incurable? The reason why it's not incurable is for the reason I was about to make, and that is, on your question, Ms. Chief Justice, the point about the city secretary and the city as an administrative whole, when the city is supposed to come up with the ballot language, they would have to do one of two things. Either they would have to fairly and correctly state all of the chief features, that's the Dacus case, and they would have to either say incumbents are or are not protected, because the citizens are saying something in their petition that is the exact opposite of what the actual charter amendment language portrays.
Actually, if you look at your interpretation of the charter language.
Well, you don't get...
There's nothing in the charter language that talks about removal from office or resignation from office or anything of that nature, is there?
There's not, but I think that's apples and oranges for two reasons. First of all, the point I was making, Your Honor, is whether it's a pleading sufficiency issue. That's a jurisdictional question. So whether or not the charter amendment should be interpreted the way we're contending that it should be interpreted is a merits decision. We don't look at the merits in deciding whether or not the pleading can be amended. And what I'm saying is that the pleading could be amended to include the claim that the city's chosen ballot language wasn't what it should have been. Now, turning to your other point, though.
A different cause of action, though. It's not complaining about the petition gatherers. It's complaining about the city secretary. So you want to be allowed to amend your pleading to start complaining about a totally different party?
Well, that party's been in since the beginning, and in the prayer paragraph, little Roman 7, we said that the city erred by even putting this on the ballot, so the city's in the case. But the point is that...
In the prayer?
I'm sorry?
Because they're in their prayer.
Section 7, we asked for 8 different terms of relief. One of the relief that we asked is that the ruling that the city should have never ordered the election in the first place. So that's in our live pleading. But what I'm suggesting is that if you don't think we got the job done on jurisdictional pleading, we should be allowed to amend that pleading to bring up the fact of the ballot language not being sufficient. And I'll say this, if you look at, to circle back to one of your earlier questions, if you look at the election code, 221.003, ballot language cases don't neatly fit within that language, and yet ballot language cases are all election contest cases. That's what Bloom says. That's what Dacus says.
Preparing a proposition for inclusion on the ballot is part of the administration of the election. Would you not agree?
I think it could be interpreted
as in fact prepared by the city, which would be an election official with the city. So yes, under Bloom and under Dacus, those in fact challenges to proposition language fall clearly within the statute.
Correct. Which is why, if you believe what we've currently pled is not appropriate to get the job done, we should be allowed to amend. But I also want to take issue with your premise, because we say the way we've currently pled it is good enough, and here's why. The point in here is that the citizen petition is not something the city has anything to do with. The language is in the document. My client who filed this lawsuit, he signed it because he thought that incumbents were going to be protected. How can you know that the outcome of this vote in November of last year is the true outcome when everybody who signed the document had been promised that incumbents are protected, when in fact on their merits argument, the opposite is true? That clear and unambiguous language in the charter amendment says that upon adoption, which was the canvassing ordinance right after the election in November of last year, upon adoption, then at that moment, anybody who has served more than 3 terms is out. Well, Sherry Capert, she had already served for 12 years, 6 terms. So according to that language, she's out. What wasn't in there, Justice Burwell, is like what Houston did. Houston actually had provisions on transition. How do you handle the fact that some people are incumbents already. That's not in this citizen petition. In here, it's clear as a bell that it says the amendment shall become effective immediately, and no person shall serve more than three terms. So if that's true, that no person can serve more than three terms, two of the city council persons, positions 2 and 6, were captured by that language and could no longer serve.
Does it not?
They're still there.
They are still there.
Does it not also say that it applies, quote, to all municipal elections conducted after the date of adoption, which means it has prospective application?
We disagree with that. It says this amendment shall become effective immediately. Well, what does the amendment say? The amendment says that upon adoption, no person shall serve more than three terms upon adoption. So as soon as the canvassing ordinance was entered, at that moment, two incumbents were no longer eligible to serve. And to your point, this amendment says that an individual voter could enjoin their conduct. So that hadn't happened yet. It could happen. Also, the fact that it hadn't happened yet, there's still all the way till May of this year, of next year, rather, for that two-year term to expire. There's also the district attorney and the AG who have the ability to remove people. And there have been votes on many, many important items of city council business that are all in jeopardy if they can't legally be there. So if the charter amendment fails for the reasons we've pled herein, all of those votes that they participated in are safe and all those ordinances are protected. Last thing I would say is that if we had not filed an election contest within 30 days, they would have said that it was a jurisdictional bar. If we had filed a deck action, they would have said that you don't have standing because you're no different than anybody else.
Your time's up, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Heath.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Robert Heath with firm Bickerstaff, Heath, Delgado, Acosta, and I'm representing the City of Arlington. Sitting at council table is Warren Lloyd, who is representing the interveners in this suit. One thing I think that's always important to understand in any election contest case, and like my friend Mr. Taylor, with whom I have been on the opposite side and on the same side in a lot of election cases. I've been working in the election area for many years. But one of the things about election contest is that they are political questions. They're not legal questions. They're not part of a court's legal or equitable jurisdiction. And the Texas Supreme Court decided that as early as 1879, at least it was actually earlier than that under earlier constitutions. But until the Constitution was amended, they didn't have any jurisdiction because it was not part of the general legal and equitable jurisdiction of the court, and it still isn't. And in fact, even after they amended in 1891, the Supreme Court said, that's not enough. You have to go back, and the legislature has to set up a framework for you to operate under, and the Supreme Court has subsequently said that framework is final and it's exclusive and it's a limitation on the courts. So if something is going to be an election contest and it's going to fit within this very special jurisdiction, then it has to fit within that statutory framework, which is in 221.003 of the Election Code. And the first thing there is you're determining that the election result is not the, determined by the canvas, is not the true result because of different things. One may be miscounted votes, which is not an issue here, as Mr. Taylor said, and the other is fraud, illegal conduct, or a mistake by an election official or other person officially involved in the administration of the election. And the very clear fact is that what was pled, the facts that are at issue here, do not fit within the election contest. Mr. Taylor's client may not like the result of the election. But if he's going to challenge the result of the election, it has to be through the framework set out in the statute, and this does not fit within it. Here, we know, for example, this is not a question about what's the true result as far as if the votes were miscounted or whatever. The thing passed by about 25,000 votes. And I think it's instructive to go back and look at Scarborough versus Eubank, also one of these very old opinions, 1899, where it talks about petitions and the effect of a petition and perhaps an invalid petition on something that happened or on the validity of an election that's already happened. And the court said that the purpose of the petition is to ascertain if there was enough support to put something on the ballot. But once you put it on the ballot, and once it passes, then you don't go back and change the result of the election because of defect in the petition. The issue here is about one sentence in the citizen-drafted petition that was circulated, received a bunch of signatures, sufficient signatures to put it on the ballot. And what that citizen petition did is it set out the entirety of the city charter amendment, verbatim. The entire amendment's on there, and it's on, I think, page 63 of the record. But it also had a summary, a four-sentence summary of that longer charter amendment. And one of those sentences is what's at issue. Even if that sentence were incorrect, which we very strongly believe it was not incorrect, it would not be sufficient to overturn the result of the election. And as was discussed earlier in the initial argument by Mr. Taylor, one of the big issues is whether the alleged mistake or illegal conduct or whatever was by an election official. It was not. It was by private citizens who were circulating the petition. Now, the authority
they don't have to be election officials. They just have to be someone who is involved in the administration of the election.
Officially involved in the administration of the election.
Officially involved in the administration of
the election.
That's right.
And I don't think that extends.
So why is the petitioning not part of the election in terms of administration?
Well, it is in bringing the matter, in this case the charter amendment, to a vote, much like, and let me go back to in the Bloom case, it talks about how the petitioners serve the role of the legislative body, that they are essentially passing the matter on to the voters. The legislature, while I think it might be involved in the election if it drafts the ballot proposition, if it sets the time of the election, but actually passing the charter amendment is not really part of the administration of the election. The administration, I think, begins when you have notice of the election, when you're actually doing all the things that bring the election to a vote.
Is there any mechanism at all with regard to these types of measures whereby there's any type of regulation of the petitioning activity? In other words, if these petitions were being taken around, and if each and every one of the individuals who was told and asked to sign it was told something that's not actually in the provision, okay, that the moon is made of green cheese or something of that nature that is not anywhere in what's on the petition that they're signing, but they're being told if you sign this, they will come kind of thing, okay? Is there any mechanism whatsoever in the election code or in the government code or in the local government code that allows the city or any type of election official to go and determine? We know they can determine whether or not the signatures are valid,
mm-hmm.
okay, something like that. But is there anything with regard to the actual text or substance of the thing being petitioned for?
I don't believe there is now.
Which is probably why the Supreme Court did what they did in Bloom with regard to giving standing to the petitioners, giving standing
right.
to challenge the propositions. But that's still a proposition that was created by an election official.
Right. That's quite, and the election official was the Houston City Council. Bloom, by the way, was not an election contest, although they talked about election
Mandate.
Contest. It was an injunction suit. I don't think there's a specific way to do that. In fact, in Woodville, if you go back and in that case, they said that once the city secretary determined that there was a sufficient number of signatories, even though the case went to a jury trial before it got to the Supreme Court, and the jury and the judge there determined there were not sufficient number, and there were, you know, whether for forgeries or other reasons, and defective affidavits and so forth, there weren't sufficient signatures. The Supreme Court said no. Once the signatures were there, according to the city secretary, it was required to be put on the ballot. So I think there is not. But in this case, there wasn't even a mistake. We talk about it, the contestant talks about it as being an erroneous interpretation or erroneous representation of what's in the proposition, but it's not in the measure, but it's not. At first, as you said, Justice Birdwell, that issue isn't in the measure, the Constitution or Charter Amendment at all. Additionally,
it would be fair, though, to say how it would, in fact, since it does state that it applies to incumbents.
It does.
It would be fair, okay, it would be a fair question to ask whether or not it requires any type of removal or resignation if, in fact, at the time it becomes effective, they have already met all the criteria for never, ever serving ever mm-hmm. again, whether that was intended.
That may be a fair question, and I think if we go and answer that question, we need to go first to the Supreme Court decision in Wentworth, and actually there are about four others following Wentworth, but I think it's the best one, where they say if you're interpreting something like that, a challenge to eligibility of someone to serve in an office, and this was a constitutional provision that it was being construed, that you construe it strictly against ineligibility. And in that case, there was a prior Supreme Court case that had construed the exact same provision of the Constitution and said Wentworth or anybody in that position would be ineligible. And the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 margin, said no. Once you apply the rule of statutory construction, the only way you come out is that in that case Wentworth was not ineligible, and that would be the same thing here. And I think what you have to do is to say that when it says, for example, in the Charter Amendment, that it goes into effect at the next municipal election, that means it goes into effect when those people come up at the next election. And furthermore, we know we don't even have to worry about what is the correct interpretation from a statutory construction, because we know what actually happened. Because they continue to serve, and the question about, well, maybe somebody could go and kick them off, the Constitution, Article 16, Section 17, says they serve until their successor is qualified. The only way to qualify their successor is to have somebody new put into office, and under the city charter, the only way to do that is by election, and under the election code, the only time you can hold that election, the only remaining time in their term of office, which ends in May of 2020, is in November of this year, and the last day to get on the ballot to fill a vacancy, the very last day, was September 20th. So we know that those people have served ever since that charter amendment was passed and will continue to serve until their term expires regularly in May of 2020. So it did not have the effect that the contestants here are saying, and that is the fundamental underlining, underscoring of their argument. If that's wrong, their whole case falls apart.
Let me ask you this question,
yes, ma'am.
Sir. And what is your response to his request that if this court agrees that there's no jurisdiction, that they were denied the right to replead?
Yes. And they would, I think they do not have a right to replead because, first, I think their pleadings demonstrate an incurable defect. You know, it's not just a pleading error. It's not that they forgot to plead some fact or whatever. It's just the case that they outlined isn't an election contest case. So that's the first thing. The second is that I think they waived it, and there are many cases that say just because you ask, you know, you need to file an amendment. Tell what, how you're going to amend it, how you're going to make it correct. The Haddix case is particularly instructive, and I can't recall the exact number of times in Haddix that they came back saying, let us file an amendment, and did nothing other than just asking, let us file. But it was probably half a dozen or certainly something close to that, and the court said, the Court of Appeals said, you've waived it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Taylor?
Sorry. May it please the court, I want to counter several things that was said. First, there is no stated exception in the body or the text of this charter amendment for incumbents. It doesn't say you can't serve more than a certain amount of time unless you got elected in the last 6 months. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say you can't serve for a certain amount of time unless your current term isn't going to finish in the next few days. It doesn't say that. There are zero exceptions. Now, the way that the citizen petitions work when you're amending the charter is the words they choose are the gospel. You can't change them. If the city had said, we don't like the way you drafted your charter amendment, we're going to rewrite it for you, that'd be improper. They have to do what the charter amendment says. So there's no discretion there. What this charter amendment says is that if it passes, no person. It doesn't say some people and some people don't. It says no person shall serve more than three terms. It also says nobody under any circumstances will serve more than 12 years. Well, City Councilperson Sherry Capert has already been in office since 2000. It's 18 years. How would she get around that? It also says...
Well, then that language doesn't turn around and erase her previous service all the way back to three terms, does it?
No, of course not. But it says in the next sentence that in determining whether you're limited or not...
You're not arguing that it retrospectively applies so that anything she participated in...
No.
...more than 3 years of active service... all of a sudden goes away because
no,
it's void.
I'm not saying that, but what I am saying, look at the next paragraph. It says the term, all prior served terms count. So we know that she and Robert Shepard, we know that they've served more than three terms. So what the citizen said is all of those count on whether or not they've hit the limit. And it even goes farther, and it says the term they're currently filling counts. And they talk about if you leave quicker or you leave later. They never contemplate or deal with transition for incumbents. Now, in Houston, they did. Incumbents were specifically dealt with. But here, it's everybody on the planet Earth. Doesn't matter if you've held office or not. Doesn't matter if you got elected the previous May or not. You can't serve more than three terms, period, paragraph. That's what it says. So here's our quandary. We've got a citizen petition that gets rid of everybody, including incumbents, but they gratuitously add and get every single person to sign a document where this is added, that don't worry, incumbents are protected. And there's a ministerial duty to put it on the ballot. So how do you challenge something like that? The only way to challenge it is for an election contest to be filed. That's the only way you can do it. And that's what we did within 30 days. If you don't think we got the job done, Your Honors, on pleading, we should be allowed to amend our pleading and complain that the ballot language didn't include chief features either. It needed to say incumbents are protected, or it needed to say that they're not, because that's a chief feature. And for those reasons, we ask that you reverse and render. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your arguments and your briefs. It's an interesting case, and I'm sure we benefited from hearing your arguments this afternoon. Our next case isn't set until 3, so your case is submitted, and we are going to take a short recess.